KD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be exploring two different topics tightly related in the case of my morning show guest, a gentleman by the name of Bruce Boyce. First of all, we're going to be talking about one of the most serious problems that has confronted American life over the last few years, the opioid crisis, which I'm sure many of you have heard a whole lot about. Bruce Boyce, as a drug company sales rep for a number of years, knows firsthand about at least some of the indiscretions that have led to this rampant problem that has caused so much suffering across the country. But beyond that story of the opioid crisis, we're also going to be confronting what it means to be a whistleblower. And that is what Bruce Boyce decided to be at one point, a whistleblower for his own company, his own drug company, which he knew to be dealing illegally in the matter of selling drugs in ways that crossed all kinds of legal and ethical boundaries and lines. And it is no small matter to be a whistleblower, particularly when it means, in a sense, disconnecting from a well-paying job for a famous company, and in a sense, leaving one vulnerable to who knows what. It takes great courage to be a whistleblower. And I so appreciate the honesty with which Bruce Boyce has written about his own story, the careful context which he creates in terms of talking about the overall drug industry and the way that it functions, and maybe misfunctions in some respects, and his own story of what it meant to decide to embark on this kind of frightening and lonely path as a whistleblower. His book, which chronicles all of this, is titled Cold Comfort: One Man's Struggle to Stop the Illegal Marketing of Powerful Opioid Drugs and Save Lives. The book is published by BB Publishing, and by the way, it includes a foreword written by one of Mr. Boyce's attorneys, Peter Chatfield, a beautifully written foreword that helps set the stage for the story which follows. Bruce Boyce, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
I know it was no small matter for you to decide to become a whistleblower, and you talk about that in the book, the circumstances under which that eventually occurred. I want to ask you, was it maybe not to the same extent, but somewhat similarly difficult to decide to tell this story as you have by writing it and sharing it with the public in this book, Cold Comfort? Tell us what prompted you to decide that you wanted to do that.
Well, we go back almost 10 years, and Peter Chatfield, that wrote the foreword of the book, has been my lead counsel in really both cases that I had. I had two cases, federal cases, QTEM cases, that lasted 14 years against the same company. And Peter just said, you know, what you went through and what happened, you really should write a book. Well, because it was 14 years in the cases, you know, some of the case was sealed by the Justice Department. So obviously you can't write the book then. So wasn't until 2017 when the second case was over that I was able to then start writing the book. And there was a period of time that I took 6 months out where I could just not, I could not go through and relive it. It was really difficult. And I had to set it down and walk away from it and writing the book. Hmm.
I know that one of the choices that you made was to change certain names to protect certain people. And I'm not sure if it's always a matter of protecting the innocent or sometimes you're protecting the guilty as well. Can you just say a word about the discretion with which you use people's actual names in the book?
What I did is that if it was, there's only one exception to the rule that I'm going to describe. And there's a reason why it occurred that way. What I did is that I used a first name alias if I was trying to protect somebody that wasn't a public figure and was really had a lot to do with what went on within that period of time, but it wasn't fair to them to bring it out publicly. And so that's how I handled that with most of those folks. There's only one. And people that were public figures like Peter Chatfield, I went ahead and used their full name. And so you, when you read the book, you can tell who's the public figure, who's not the public figure. The other, the only exception to that was that Greg, the lead investigator with Office of Criminal Investigation for the FDA, wind up being private in the sense that he was still an agent. And you certainly don't want to use his real name as being a federal agent. He wound up speaking to 60 Minutes and it was about a month ago that Greg interviewed 60 Minutes on their opioid crisis episode that they used my case as an example. And when that happened, then I called Greg and I said, come on, guy, I've got to use your name now. You outed yourself. And he said, okay, so you'll see Greg in the text, but you won't see his last name. And the reason why it was easier is supposed to just change, you know, the alias name to Greg.
Well, when someone has a great name like Greg, you should include it if you possibly can. So I understand. Very good. You mentioned at one point when you began to feel guilty about some of what you were being asked to do as a drug sales rep, that you began to keep a journal. And that, yes, that was maybe one way for you to kind of sort out what you were going through, maybe a reliever of stress and so on. How valuable was it in the writing of this book to turn to those journals? I mean, did you keep them after all these years, and were they valuable to you?
Oh my gosh, they were tremendously valuable. You know, part of it, you can journal to help yourself through difficult emotional times. And it's a mainstay within psychology that you can journal and you can help yourself out in certain circumstances. And one of the things that I noticed is that it would be nice to wind up having a journal because basically, Greg, I wasn't trusting a lot of people. I wasn't trusting my lawyers. I wasn't trusting like the investigators or, you know, and so I kept a journal so that I could keep track of all the facts involved as I moved through the process, that I could have a record of, okay, I'm on a phone call and I'm on the phone call with the Justice Department and the Justice Department is asking me to wear a wire and they're asking me to do this or do that. And I'm going to write that down because I'm not going to remember that. And, you know, that might have been 14 years ago. So it became really invaluable. In fact, in the first case, the judge said, what caused you to do this? Because this is genius. Because we're going to use this as a timeline for the wrongdoing by the company. So it was a really, it not only helped me, but it helped the case as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Bruce Boyce and talking about his book called Cold Comfort, One Man's Struggle to Stop the Illegal Marketing of Powerful Opioid Drugs and Save Lives. Bruce Boyce ended up being a whistleblower for a biotech company called Cephalon, with which he worked for a time. And the fact that he was willing to step forward had enormous consequences for that company, which would be certainly one of the companies that is thought of now as a leading villain in the opioid crisis, with which our country, of course, is still contending. Bruce Boyce, I wish we had more time to talk about this. The first chapter of your book tells us a little bit about who you are and the kind of stock that you come from, and especially the ethical sturdiness of your own father. And I want you to tell our listeners a little bit more about your dad, and I would love for you to share a story with them that you share in your book about something that he did during the war that really shows us what he was made of and the way in which he was willing to go to great lengths to do what he thought was right.
And you're talking about when he almost got court-martialed?
Yes.
He did have a way of deciding his own ship and where he was going to go. He was a medic in the Pacific, and he was somehow attached to a battalion of African American folks that were in. They weren't officers; they were just privates and sergeants and. And as I understand the story, he wound up putting him in a sort of a swampy area. And so the tents were in a swampy area. And as you well know, that's disease ridden and bugs and all kinds of stuff. And so what he did is that he wound up going to the officers' quarters that was elevated, I think, and had wooded slats around, tore those off, made floors that were elevated off the swampy ground, and he was in a world of trouble with that, and almost got court-martialed. And basically, because he was a good officer and he was a good leader of men at that time it was in the Pacific Theater, obviously, they couldn't really do anything with him. They reprimanded him, but he went on to be decorated and also commissioned in the field.
So he was somebody who was a figure of great strength to you and your brother, and also someone who believed in discipline and right and wrong. And I don't think you would tell us all that you do about your dad unless you didn't think he played a major role in shaping who you have grown up to be.
Very much so. Very much so. I think one of the things that tells a lot about him is a small incident where we were young, 10 years old, my brother and I in the car, and there was a head-on traffic accident. And dad pulled over and said, you know, kids, stay in the car. And he got out, and it was probably 10 or 12 people that were involved in a four-car accident. And he went from person to person and did triage. My dad always wore a white shirt, and I'll never forget when he got in the car, the white shirt was all red, had blood all over it. And it was just his style, what he was like. And that's what he expected from my brother and I, that kind of duty.
It's interesting when you started to think about what kind of career to undertake, you find that one of the first want ads that you end up answering, and which ultimately lands you your first major job, was as a sales rep with a pharmaceutical company. And you tell us that it was a rather odd choice because growing up, you knew that your dad did not like sales reps, especially those from drug companies. Tell us more about what he had said about drug reps.
Well, he thought that a drug rep was basically coming in to promote a drug, and he thought that was unethical. He thought that his decision on what to use and where to use it is because he had a medical license, and that provided the necessary authority in what he wanted to do. And so when somebody came in and tried to sell him something, he wound up usually throwing them out. So the most difficult doctor I've ever called on in my career was my father.
So I appreciate the fact that you, as you described the work that you first began doing for a pharmaceutical company called Carter Wallace, you kind of spell out the whole kind of framework within which these kind of companies operate, with sales rep having a particular territory and specific products and so on. Describe to our listeners kind of from the bottom up how a company like Carter Walls functions and the place of the sales rep within that framework.
Well, first of all, they tried to, the pharmaceutical industry tried to sell products without sales reps, and they didn't do a very good job. And so they put them back in the field. When they did, they gave them zip codes, and then depending on what kind of products they had, whether the product was a bronchodilator for pulmonologist, or whether it was an antihistamine for allergist, they would wind up having targeted doctors in a certain zip codes, and that rep would be responsible for those zip codes, and that's how a territory would be put together. And so the rep then would be trained in the training process to understand studies and the package insert, and to study pharmacology, pharmacokinetics, and pharmacodynamics. And so those are the sort of the basis, the nuts and bolts, and how a rep then got started. And then as they made the call to a physician, they would talk about the positives of their drug from the package insert and talk about the studies. And so most of the time, most of the reps were trained pretty thoroughly into dissecting studies from on their drugs and also their competition.
I think it's kind of interesting for just a regular person from the outside looking in, thinking about somebody knowing more than the doctor would know about a given medication. But I think when people don't stop to think about all that a medical doctor needs to know, right, there's just no way that a given doctor can know everything there is to know about every potential medication, including new medications coming on the market all the time. So it probably makes more sense for a sales rep to play that function than it might seem at first glance.
I think one of the shocks I got when I first got in the industry and started calling on physicians was the sign that an older gentleman had on his desk, and he said, "Sales reps have 5 minutes, and if not, you're thrown out." And so you had to make a quick assessment, whether that's intuitiveness or empathy, about where the doctor's needs were with your product, or whether the doctor could use the product or not within certain patients that maybe he's failed other therapies. And so you had to be quick to get to the point. And it wasn't a lot of back and forth that you would try to hard sell somebody. You went right into a clinical discussion about your drug and the doctor's patients.
And one of the points that you make early on in the book is that there is a certain line that is not to be crossed when it comes to sales reps and what they are permitted to say to a doctor about drugs. And this involves something called off-label marketing. Explain to our listeners what this is and why this practice is in fact illegal.
Off-label marketing is really the pharmaceutical company promoting their product outside of the FDA's approved indication. Now, you can wind up having a physician you can have a physician write a prescription for a drug that's off label. And the physician has every right to do that. If they have a patient that has failed other therapies and the doctor feels like the drug can be used for that patient after they failed other therapies, it's more than likely that the prescription's written, and also insurance will pick that up a lot of times because of that. But for a pharmaceutical company to turn around and promote a drug off label, that's going outside of the original indication that the FDA has approved that drug for, and can be very dangerous.
Right. So I think for just regular folks, an example that might make sense to them is if anybody has seen the film Awakenings with Dr. Oliver Sacks, who works with a number of patients who have suffered these strange comas that have lasted for decades, including Robert De Niro's character. And then I don't remember exactly how it happens, but this Dr. Sachs stumbles upon giving them huge doses of, I think, dopamine, which for unknown reasons seems to snap some of them out of these comas that they've suffered through for years and years and years. And there would be nothing on, in a sense, the label of the bottle that would suggest that dopamine should be used for that. But there was nothing illegal about Dr. Sachs using it in that way. But if somebody selling dopamine had gone to him and urged him to use it in this, in a sense, unofficial way, that would have been illegal. That would be a line that a drug rep is not supposed to cross.
Correct.
Interesting. One of the things you say is it can be a gray area because, to some extent, conversations between doctors and drug reps are protected by the First Amendment. So, in your book, you kind of share an informal example of how such a conversation like that might occur in a way that would convey the same amount of information, but in a way that would not be precisely illegal. Can you just describe that sort of circumstance?
And I'm trying to think of what I wrote in the book. I'm sorry. I'm just not. What was the?
It's just something about how doctors and sales reps could have conversations of a more informal nature in which a drug rep might kind of mention some of these things in passing. I mean, there is a way in which some of this information could be conveyed, but not if the sales rep sort of took the lead in a sense.
Right, and here's for your listeners. Dr. Greg, can you want to try Actic for pain patients that have low back pain or migraine? Now that's a direct off-label assault on a doctor. That's straight up frontal. That's illegal. But another way of doing it is that, Dr. Greg, don't you have pain patients that have failed traditional therapies? And your answer would be sure. Well, would you like to try this product, Actic, for those patients? Because if you notice, it is in this receptor site, that's the typical drug that you're using now, but this is the drug that you could use that really you may get better results from. And the doctor would go, yeah, I'm really interested in that. Can you give me that some information? And so one of the ways the rep would do is fill out a MRF form. We called it a MRF, which is medical information request form, and send it into the company. Well, all it was a way to get back in the doctor's office and continue your conversation to sell a product off label.
Mm. And to sell a given medication for uses other than the normal use. And if a doctor becomes open to that possibility, then of course that doctor is more apt to prescribe that medication more often because you're prescribing it beyond its original purposes for which the FDA approved it. And I'm not sure we've yet spelled this out in so many words, but the reason all of this is so crucial for the well-being, for the success of a given sales rep, is because of what a sales rep gets every time a given medication is prescribed. Explain the nuts and bolts in that, of the mechanics by which you get money in your pocket every time a given doctor prescribes a drug. How does that work?
Well, a lot of people would think it's a more direct line, A to B, and it's really not. Hmm. Because the pharmaceutical company manufactures the drug. The pharmaceutical company sells it to a wholesaler. The wholesaler holds that drug when the pharmacy requests a refill of a said drug. So that drug then is requested by a pharmacy, pharmacy A, because Dr. B wrote a script for Actic. So then it travels through. Now, when that script is filled and the pharmacist records that information goes to the pharmaceutical company that has that product. And so that rep then in that zip code for that drug from that doctor gets paid a commission.
And that's, of course, where it gets difficult because that means that it is in a sales rep's own interest to get doctors to prescribe a given medication as much as possible. So it is not, in a sense, there are all kinds of incentives in place which are going to tempt any normal drug rep to perhaps cross certain lines and push certain drugs in ways that are not going to ultimately benefit patients who need help.
Let me give you a scenario. And this is why this is so dangerous. This is why people have no idea, really, still today, that this occurred. Is that you have a drug, Actique, which is a fentanyl product. A fentanyl product is used step up. So if the pain patient is not doing well in on morphine, they go maybe to a fentanyl drug because it the other product, the lower product, has failed. They go to a much more potent drug. When you decide you're going to sell off label, you're selling to drug naive patients. And so most of these patients are it is contraindicated for patients that are drug naive to opioids. So patients that are migraine patients, that's extremely dangerous. And if you wind up having a rep saying, hey, look, Bruce Boyce, you're a rep and you're in this territory and we're gonna launch this drug and we're gonna sell it to low back patients and we're gonna sell it to migraine patients, but we're not gonna pay you on the low dose because we make more money on the high dose.
Hmm.
And so what you get into is reps are, you know, slamming those doors, getting into those offices, trying to sell that drug to wind up making commission. And basically what they're doing is that they're giving a really dangerous dose initially, maybe to a patient that's never had an opioid before.
Wow.
And that's where you get an overdose. That's where you get addiction.
Hmm.
One out of four heroin addicts started off with an opioid prescription.
Hmm. So it didn't start out with, in a sense, a crime, except the crime that maybe occurred with the doctor and or sales rep and
right.
and a prescription that should never have happened in the first place. And it speaks to something that you tell us became an important part of the pharmaceutical industry way back in the 1980s. You tell us when drug company sales reps began to serve doctors as unofficial consultants. And of course, it's one thing when that is done all above board for all of the right motivations and reasons. It's another thing when that consultation work by sales reps is driven by the profits that they want to earn.
Yeah, the greed, yes.
We're speaking with Bruce Boyce. We're talking about his book, Cold Comfort, One Man's Struggle to Stop the Illegal Marketing of Powerful Opioid Drugs and Save Lives. So you work for a number of years, 17 years at least, for Carter Wallace.
Yes.
And not too long after you start there, you are promoted to their CNS division, which means drugs for the central nervous system. And you are extremely successful with them. I want to just have you take just a second. I wish we had more time for this, but you are trained by somebody in the company named Trevor, or you call him Trevor. And one of the things he does to help you become more successful is he helps you, in a sense, embrace your own body, your own big athletic frame, which you were until then sort of apologetic about. Just say a quick word about this interesting advice he gave you and what a difference it made for you.
He was the man was brilliant. And to be honest, he was wasting his time at this smaller pharmaceutical company training reps because he was well educated. He was a teacher by trade, and he was an amazing person. And you, when you do stand up presentations, you have to be able to, you know, have a presence. And he would come to me and he goes, "You're slumped and you got your head down." And he goes, "Stand up. You're a big guy." And it's like, you know, use that to your advantage and have some confidence in yourself. And Greg, honestly, that changed my view of myself in business from then on. It was an amazing gift by him.
You also said that because for kind of a lot of different reasons, you and your brother through a lot of your childhood and adolescence had felt a little bit like outsiders with some of your peers. You feel like that gave you, in a sense, a higher level of intuition. You say, I had a kind of intuition that was a byproduct of my peripheral thinking. And you say that also served you well in this work.
Right, very much so. Very much so. You know, when you only have 5 minutes and the doctor says, hey, look, you got 5 minutes and I got patient A, and I've got all my rooms filled. You only got 5 minutes. What do you got? And where it helped me was that I realized that I had a lot of intuitiveness, that when I was younger, I had to figure out what was going on pretty quickly with friends or people I met, because I didn't have a lot of time. I didn't have a lot of background. I didn't live in one place where I had summers with somebody that it worked well in relationships. So what happened was that I had to have this intuition, and also I developed this empathy. Well, if you have empathy and intuition, it serves you well in sales. Absolutely. And so that helped an awful lot.
Yeah. So as I said, you were extremely successful with Carter Wallace for quite a few years, but then something really terrible occurs involving a drug called Felbatol. Yeah. And this is something in which the company begins pushing it in a way that ultimately led to disaster for certain patients. And professionally, it sort of led to, if not outright disaster, a really painful reversal for you. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Felbatol was an anti-epileptic drug that was indicated for Lennox-Gastaut. Lennox-Gastaut seizure syndrome is multiple seizures. It's usually the folks that are, as their kids wear helmets, they're institutionalized. And if I can remember this, it's atonic. And the atonic is where the head goes to the chin and they do a head dive. And that's why they wear the helmets. And so Felbatol was this really innovative, progressive product that it seemed like it was working really well with those patients. And here's the difference between a corrupt or immoral pharmaceutical company and one that's not high science. And Carter Wallace was just not high science. And so once you get into a product that goes beyond their preclinicals, where their studies they show, you know, because stage 1, 2, and 3 cover side effects and efficacy within a product to get it approved by the FDA. But a lot of times it's not 100,000 patients. And so what happened with Felbatol is that we had idiosyncratic reaction of aplastic anemia and hepatic failure with patients taking Felbatol, and those patients died. And what happened was that I was hospital rep, and I was ranked one or two in the nation. I was doing really well, and I made great friends with one of the chiefs in one of the teaching institutions, and he invited me to Grand Rounds, and we always had a really good relationship. And he said, Bruce, I want you to sit in the front row. And I thought this was a little odd, because normally they don't put a pharmaceutical rep in the front row. You know, they have the EKG up there talking about a patient, and the front row was for clinicians that were dealing with that patient. So I went up, sat in the front row, and I was sitting next to this lovely lady, and the Grand Rounds started. Well, the Grand Rounds was on me. The Grand Rounds was about Felbatol, and she developed hepatic failure, and they saved her life. And it burned in me about how we are, as reps, responsible for what we say and what we do, well beyond what it says as far as in the company manual.
Right. And that patient very likely could have, should have died. And you had a role in that. And it was a powerful, painful moment for you, a moment of learning. You realized pretty quickly that you no longer wanted to work for this company. You were ultimately, in a sense, demoted and ultimately moved on to this very different company called Cephalon, dramatically different company. Explain some of the ways in which this company functioned differently and just had a dramatically different flavor and personality than Carter Wallace.
The Carter Wallace is Carter liver pills, and you go back to the turn of the century, 1900s, old company, old New York company. And so it was a traditional, very traditional pharmaceutical company. And, you know, it was much older. The people involved were older. And not that that was bad in the sense, but the way they process things, the way they would do studies, and it just took forever. And it was just a really different approach to pharmaceutical sales. And when I went to Cephalon, it was all these younger folks. It was Frank Baldino was the CEO, and he was charismatic and young, and he was a PhD in biopharmaceutical. And it was really a complete different turnaround. And very aggressive. They were all very aggressive and very smart folks. And at first, I loved it. It was a great change. And I moved back into neurology, which is what I love. I really enjoyed neurology. I still do sometimes. Hmm.
You tell us that this was a company that was extremely aggressive, which is one reason why they were being so incredibly successful. And it became sort of part of the institutional intent that Cephalon would really push off-label sales. And of course, as we've already talked about, drug reps aggressively pushing this kind of marketing was something that was illegal. And it troubled you a great deal to be part of this. One of the questions you kind of posed to yourself as you write this book is you were trying to figure out the whole culture of Cephalon, which bothered you a great deal. I mean, you call it a very coarse culture at one point. There's a lot of drinking and other poor behavior and so on. And you kind of wonder which came first. Did that culture of kind of loose morals and loose ethics, did that allow this illegal activity to occur, or did this illegal activity and the fact that people were getting away with it sort of foster this culture that turned you off so much? I'm not sure you still know the answer to what came first.
I bad character, I think, starts it. And I think that when you wind up having your own personal bad character intersect in your corporation bad character, you're going to run into problems. And that's what occurred with that.
Interesting. So you have already touched on this Actique that is one of the drugs that was at the center of all of this, 100 times as powerful as morphine, and a drug that was clearly being misused in a lot of different ways, and actually ingested typically in the form of what looked like a lollipop. I mean, it's just amazing to think about the way in which people were being set up, as though consciously set up to become addicted to this, to use this as though it's no big deal, it's no more dangerous than a lollipop. And then it's this powerful drug that ends up ruining people's lives.
Well, especially in its delivery, that as you use the lollipop, you know, it's absorbed in the mucosa here in your mouth, and the absorption rate is so much faster. And so what's happening is that it's the way they approached how they were going to deliver it, you know, and actually what occurred in the first case with, you know, gabapentin was being promoted off-label, Provigil this off-label, and also Actique. And what happened was that, you know, Fintora came along, and they were switching patients over from Actiq to Fintora. And they were, again, being paid the higher dollar amount for the higher dose. Trouble is with Fintora, Fintora is twice the bioavailability as what Actiq is. And so initially what occurred were overdoses. And that's how the Justice Department actually started the second investigation in the second case.
You actually hear from a registered nurse at a sleep center who hadn't heard from you in a while and hadn't gotten any free samples in a while. And as she reached out to you, when she kind of shared some of her own misgivings, apparently the great profits from off-label marketing for the company was making news in the Wall Street Journal. So, but of course, it wasn't necessarily generated by anything being done illegally by drug reps. But nevertheless, this was happening, and she had her suspicions. And when you shared your own misgivings, she ultimately puts you in touch with this gentleman named Greg, who sets you on the path to being a whistleblower. Tell us what Greg asked you to do and who he was working for.
Greg was he was a federal agent with Office of Criminal Investigation, OCI. OCI is the federal agents for the FDA. And I ultimately got in touch with him and met with him. And I thought that what I was going to do was turn over documentation to help stop what the company was doing. Because I looked at it like I wanted to save my job and I wanted to save the company. And so my first thought was this was not to be a whistleblower. It was to stop what they were doing, to try to protect people, but also to save my job and keep the company viable. And so I thought I would just turn over the documentation. They would do their thing and they'd go and tell the company to stop doing what they're doing. And I'd go back, you know, being a rep or whatever I wanted to do. And what occurred is that Greg said, would you wear a wire? And I'm thinking, wear a wire? This is a whole another level, you know? And then I realized, well, you're in it for a penny and for a pound. This is what you wanted to do. You wanted to make sure this stopped. And people, you felt like people were going to die from this. And so this is what I was going to do. So I wore a wire with the feds and worked with the Justice Department for almost 2 years. And I didn't even know what a whistleblower was. And so I worked with them until Greg came up to me and said, Bruce, you really need to find a lawyer so that you can file a case against the company, because I think you're behind in filing. Everybody else is starting to file against the company. And so I said, well, why do I need a lawyer? And I told this to Greg. I go, Greg, I don't need a lawyer. I'm trying to do the right thing. I thought he meant that I needed a lawyer because I was selling off label. And he was saying, no, you need a lawyer so you could file a QI-TEM case in federal court so you can be part of what you've already started. Other people have already got word of what the investigation was and were filing their False Claims Act cases in front of me. And so that's how, and that's when I got a hold of Peter Chatfield. And that's when I became a whistleblower.
Mm. So that means that, you know, in a sense, kind of another threshold. One of the things you tell us is that early on there was all kinds of training that had to go on in terms of you being asked the same questions day after day after day after day in the cause of building a completely reliable and solid case. Explain briefly what that means.
Well, a lot of times what you had is that, you know, I would be at that time I was still working for the company. I was still making my calls. And so I can remember vividly where I was making a call to a physician in Lancaster, Ohio, and he wanted Gabatril samples for anxiety, which Gabatril was a seizure drug. And I was dropping off the samples, and I get a call on my phone, and it's Greg. And I go, oh, it's Greg. Okay, I'll get the signature. I'll be right back. I got to step out from the office. I excused myself. I picked it up. I go, yeah, Greg, what do you want? He goes, look, I've got most of Justice here, and they'll introduce themselves. You ready to take the call? And I said, sure. And it was like 12 people. And it was 12 people that were at Justice Department, and he was on the phone call. And so it'd be like somebody, one of the lawyers would ask a question, well, how are they promoting Provigil? How are they promoting Actique? How are they doing this? And I would explain how they were doing it. And then another lawyer would say, well, what are they doing with the doctors in the CME accreditations? Who are they promoting? What was going on? And then another lawyer would say, so what happened to the promotion with Gabatril? And then I'd have to re-answer and pull that back together. And one of the things I did was that I wrote things down, because you could barely keep track of everything that was happening by doing the job and still being an undercover informant for the government at the same time.
Wow. And of course, your book takes us painstakingly through this process by which you serve as a whistleblower. In fact, it's about halfway through the book that you first agree to wear a wire. And from that point on, you tell us about what that was like, including the first couple of instances when, for some reason, nothing got recorded and so on.
It didn't work. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But ultimately, you are able to make headway and make things happen. And of course, this professionally becomes extremely difficult for you, especially when you are dismissed from Cephalon and, in a sense, blackballed in the whole pharmaceutical industry. And the rewards that ultimately came back to you were a long time coming. So this was a long, difficult gauntlet. During the time that you were doing this, were you ever tempted to try to stop and say, I don't want to do this anymore, or I don't want to see this through to the end? Or once you were on this path, was there no way to get off it?
I think, Greg, a lot of it was the latter. It was really a situation where you had worn the wire, you know, and after the FDA bust in Las Vegas, it was really a situation where I really could not look back where I was going at that time. It really was something where I had to finish it and keep going with it. And I think that served me well, that tenaciousness, that sort of stubbornness about completing the task and not giving up. And I think that's really important for your listeners, because if you feel passionately about something in life, don't give up on it.
Hmm. Well, your book ultimately tells us about the years in which you lived kind of hand to mouth. I mean, a very, very difficult, precarious financial situation for you. But ultimately, of course, this company is brought to justice. And ultimately, you receive well-deserved recognition and compensation for the courageous stand that you took. And I also appreciate the fact that you tell the story of this experience as honestly as you do, really not painting yourself always in the most heroic of terms, but just as one ordinary man trying to do his best with a really difficult situation. Do you think that's a fair summation of what this book is about?
I think so. I believe that individuals can make a difference, that any individual can make a huge difference. They just have to follow through with that. And that's an important factor and lesson, I think, within the book.
Hmm. That's one reason why I'm glad you wrote this book. Again, it's titled Cold Comfort, One Man's Struggle to Stop the Illegal Marketing of Powerful Opioid Drugs and Save Lives. You'll find it at BB Publishing, and the author, Bruce Boyce. Bruce Boyce, thank you so much, first of all, for taking this courageous stand and doing what you did. And writing about it then so well in your book, Cold Comfort. And thank you for being part of the morning show today. I've really enjoyed this.
Hey, thank you much. Just for your audience, bruceboyce.com, and they can go to my website and they can find the book to order on Amazon.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a look back at one of the most glamorous teams in NFL history, the Los Angeles Rams of the 1950s. Jim Hock's father was a member of that team, and Jim Hock's wonderful memoir is called Father on the Line.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we remind you that The Morning Show is also available to you as a podcast with a different morning show 7 days a week. It's available on Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, all of the major podcast platform providers. Just make sure that you look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Burr.